I do not like to fly. I will fly. I don't sit there white-knuckled. I fold my hands peacefully in my lap, perhaps in an attitude of prayer. I don't know. But I am just back from a trip that required, and I had carefully counted these, 12 takeoffs and landings, 6 takeoffs, 6 landings. So we counted those faithfully all the way over. And as we started back with only half of them left, you leave Maui and land in Honolulu, and you leave Honolulu and land in Dallas, and you leave Dallas, and all of a sudden you're down to one more. And so as we were approaching Wichita, and the pilot said, would the stewardesses please prepare for landing, and would the passengers buckle their safety belts and so forth, I looked at her, and she looked at me, and we said, one more. And about then, we smelled the acrid smell of burning electrical wires. And I looked out the window and said, you know, he only has one flap down. There's something peculiar. And at that moment, we lifted up again and began to circle the city. And he came on in a couple of minutes and said, ladies and gentlemen, we have a problem. Which was what I needed to hear. So we circled a while, but it had a good ending, obviously, since two of us are here who were wondering for a moment or so whether we would be or not. Welcome to this beautiful room and the wonderful people in it, and this happy Easter morning. And I ask you to listen now for a moment creatively and as critically as you like. History knows at least 2 famous men who had some connection with tent making, but who made for themselves a place in the world's memory because they did something else. One of them was the Apostle Paul, a Christian missionary who supported himself at times by weaving tents, and whose brilliance and passion carried the new religion out of its small home base to conquer the Greek and Roman worlds. And the other was a Persian poet known as Omar the Tent Maker, or to most of us in the West, as Omar Khayyam. Omar knew astronomy well enough to devise a new calendar, and he knew math well enough to write an Arabic book on algebra. But if you met him somewhere in your school career, it would most likely have been through a long poem called The Rubaiyat, where he writes with gentle nostalgia about the fleeting sweetness of life and how moments once passed are lost to us forever. One of his quatrains, those 4-line stanzas, made a lasting impression on me in high school, at that stage in life when many of us like to immerse ourselves in a kind of melodramatic pessimism. Do you remember this stanza? The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. Nor all your piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all your tears wash out a word of it. What's done is done, Omar says. And no matter how smart you are or how much religious faith you have, you can't change even the smallest part of the past. Even if you shed heartbroken tears, they obliterate not a single word of what has been unalterably written. It's true, of course, even if it does sound melancholy. But it's not the whole truth. It doesn't bother to tell you that you can use the past to make new and better beginnings, that it's a long, long time in anyone's life before it's too late to start over. I suppose this will mean a lot or a little, depending on where you are this morning in age and experience. I can only tell you that when I look back over my own life, one of the things I have most reason to be grateful for is that there were so many fresh starts. One of the many things I liked about teaching in a university, for example, was that every few months I got to start all over again. New course, new faces, new hopes, so that I kept myself excited by the prospect of doing it better the next time. I like spring for the same reason. I wait for the green and gold and the buds swelling on the trees like someone fresh out of prison. No wonder, I think, that the early Christians took over the old Germanic festival of spring and fused it with their own story of a risen Christ. Easter is about a change. It says that something new was born after the dark night of the cross, and it says resurrections are possible in people's minds and hearts in every generation. Let's make it personal. If we could take a survey this very morning, how many of us would be found wishing we could start all over again? A new set of habits, a new way of living, a new and better way of expressing how we feel about the people who count in our lives. And how many of us, after that first wistful hope, will be settling once again for something less and reminding ourselves of all the old cliches. It would be nice, but it's just too hard. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. The leopard doesn't change his spots. Once you get into the rut, you can't get out. I don't believe those things. The best thing about Christianity for me is the message that something can come back to life inside us even when we thought it was all dead and finished forever. When one of my favorite authors says, "You can't go home again," he speaks much truth, but not all of it. It depends partly on where you have located home and how you define it. We celebrate this morning the idea that no one is stuck forever on the road she is now traveling. That is, unless she really isn't traveling at all, but simply drifting. A ship with a rudder traveling in the wrong direction can be turned around, but a ship with no rudder at all can't be steered in any consistent direction until it gets one. And lots of people have no rudder, no convictions to help them steer one way rather than in two or three others. People have said to me at times, "It must really help you stay young in heart to be around college students so much of the time." And I have agreed that this is one of the joys of teaching. But once again, it's only part of the truth, because it's an odd fact also that too many young students are psychologically ancient, caught up in a kind of backwash, no idea of what they want or what road to take, mastered by no great compulsion, warmed by no fire, listless and bored by what they see as some imposed duty rather than a door opening. The truth is that some of the most exciting people I have known were in the second half of life, well into it already, starting down new roads, learning new things, changing old habits, alive because they keep hope in the front of their minds. But about right here, I start to get a little nervous because the words may sound too easy. It's time to say that starting over is not always simple or joyful. More often than not, I suppose, it can begin in pain, which is something else this Easter morning should tell us. The man, after all, whom the Jews called Yeshua and the Greeks called Jesus, that man, that remarkable man, was terribly humiliated. The center fell apart. The bright dream turned into a nightmare of agony and blood. And all sense and logic said that it should have ended right there. But for 2,000 years, we have known that it didn't. Many of our own personal beginnings start with a cross. The most traumatic experiences in my own life took me through embarrassment and pain to a resurrection I couldn't even imagine at the time. I would say to myself, there can't be another college where I'll be as happy as I am here. Or I would say dolefully, there can't be another pulpit as fulfilling as this one, only to be wrong every single time. I came to understand that I had to die to each of those worlds before I could be resurrected to others that were even better. And part of the wisdom of a new life is that you can look back and read what the moving finger wrote and understand it as you never could when you were caught up in the middle of the story. Maybe we need to remember that each transition from one stage of life to another is a form of death and resurrection. If I look at my children, I see now totally new people. Not the toddlers I used to know or the infant faces captured in photographs and slides. Those children are gone. Not a cell in their physical bodies is the same. They have all passed through forms of dying to grow into something else. And that's the cycle. Life, death, resurrection. Life, death, resurrection. The Easter story may come once a year for churches, but it's played out every day in every year of our lives. Not always from a prison or a grave, but sometimes. And the painful truth is that in this room, like every other full church in town this morning, we have our quota of prisoners, some of whom were captured a long time ago and have gotten used to captivity. Here sits one who is incarcerated in a prison of self. You know what it means. The walls, the floor, the ceiling, all made of mirrors, reflecting back endlessly his own image. Someone who has almost forgotten that outside that small room of monotonous repetition, there is a larger world. And here sits another, caught in the grip of some habit, she could live so much better without, trapped perhaps in a cell of bad temper, handcuffed by hatred or jealousy, captured by greed, until all she can think of is more and more and more. We have our living deaths and our cells, but we also see some of our friends get out of them. How many alcoholics I have known over the years who started over courageously? How many kids hooked on drugs who shook off the grave clothes and walked free? How many dying marriages resurrected because love rolled away the stone of indifference? We always have to let go of something in order to make a new beginning, and some cannot do it or will not. I know people at 30 and 40 who can't love their mates or their kids or their friends because they are still looking hopelessly for a parental love they were denied when they were children. They can't let the old resentment and bitterness die, and so there is no chance for resurrection. What I've been trying to say is that Easter is not just something that happened once. It's something that happens over and over. Not simply a past event to be celebrated with a new hat and loud hallelujahs, but a promise that your whole life can be a series of resurrections. A very fine man wrote me a letter once in which he lamented the fact that I did not call for a commitment at the end of my sermons, that I did not, in the language of the church he had grown up in, extend an invitation. But the fact is, I tried to tell him, I always do. Not to walk down an aisle or kneel at an altar, but to let a new life spring up somewhere deep inside where it really counts, even if nothing is visible at the very first. You can't go home again? Oh, yes, you can. Not to the old house you lived in once on 13th Street or North Main. Not to the faces you knew in some half-forgotten year. Not to the summer of 42 or the fall of 55. But the heart has a home. The mind remembers the roots of decency and all the good things you once intended to do. There is a quiet green place where we can be at peace with ourselves again, and what's more, we know how to find it. We know the way back, and we know it especially this morning because this is Easter, the day of new hope and new beginnings, and because if you see the symbol of death out of the corner of your eye as you look at me, a cross on which ignorance and malice thought they had written the last word, you also can see all around you the symbols of eternal hope. A green quilt of new grass around this building, a riot a vibrant color in this room, the white trumpets of lilies through which spring blows the everlasting song of new life, new beginnings, resurrection. And the most important thing in the world is that each one of us can have that. Happy Easter.